Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice-weekly podcast for people who play with needles. No Christine this week, but we do have with us owner of Needle in a Haystack, Kathy Ray. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Gary.
Good to have you with us. Now, 20 years.
Yep.
20 years in business. That's quite an accomplishment because in there is included the Great Recession.
Which was a challenge.
I have no
that's
doubt.
That's being polite. Yeah.
I mean, that's impressive. Any shop like this in any hobby, I think, that can do 20 years plus is a huge accomplishment.
Well, I think for any shop that survives that long, regardless of who the owner is, a lot of it really is both made up by the customers and the staff. You know, you can't really run a needlework store unless you've got really great staff. And even if that changes over time, who those people are, having knowledgeable, helpful people who like what they do and like coming to work, that makes a big difference.
Yeah. And that's so true because, yeah, you have people working with you in your store who are enthusiastic, and that just spreads to the customer. And plus, you can't help everybody. So,
No. There aren't enough hours in the day as it is.
Yeah. No, that's now you were a fascinating background here, a computer programmer person.
Yep.
And managed computer department. And somewhere along in there where you started the shop while you were still working.
I did. Well, I've stitched since I was about six. I turned 63 a couple of weeks ago. So I've stitched pretty much my entire life.
Oh, we're the same age. That's special. That's special.
Oh, excellent. Okay. 55 was a good year.
Yes.
I had been traveling a lot and would go to visit needlework stores all around the country, overseas, wherever I was traveling for my day job. And I just kind of really wanted to build a shop that I wanted to shop in. And that's really what started it. And part of it is I can blame on a friend of mine, C.A. Wells. C.A. was a needlework designer and teacher. She never had a retail store, but she knew shop owners all around the world. And I said to her once, I would really like to do this at some point. And she said, well, why don't you? And I went, well, because I have a day job. And she said, you know, I know people who already do that. So I kind of investigated other people who own stores who weren't in them full time and decided it was something I could do as long as I could find the right staff. And my first shop manager is Ada Hayden, who is now the owner of iCandy Needle Art. She became a needlepoint designer. And it started from a love of needlework and the belief that kind of the, you know, field of dreams, if you build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
That if I built the kind of shop that I wanted to shop in, that other people would feel that way as well. And I took 6 months off work. Actually, I didn't really take the entire 6 months off, but I worked only a couple of days a week for 6 months to put it all together. And then I still didn't quite come back full time after the shop opened. I worked for about another 4 months part time and then went back to my day job full time for about 3 or 4 years before I got laid off in the 2001 bubble that burst in the Bay Area. High tech, you know, we got lots of bubbles here. It was my company. I was working for a startup by that point. I'd left Sun Microsystems and gone to work for a startup. And, you know, we went from being a company of, I don't know, like about 85 people down to about 30 people. And I took a year off in the process of that, worked in the shop, not every day, but most days, and then decided I didn't want to go back. Fortunately, I have an amazing husband, Carl thinks there isn't anything that I can't do. And so at one point I looked at him and said, I think I don't want to go back to high tech. And he goes, I already knew that. And he just decided he needed to let me figure it out.
Uh-huh.
And he was fine with that. And so I traded in a high tech day job, which I loved in some ways and hated in others. There were days when I wanted to come home and kill people. Mm-hmm. and I just decided that the shop was really where I needed to be. It wasn't where I planned to be at that point. I kind of planned I might not get here till about now, but I'm not sorry that I did it in the manner that it happened.
So you were really fortunate, and because that was one of the things I wondered is how you have a shop, and yeah, you can hire the right person, but you still have to be involved and a full-time job in a pretty high pressure industry.
Yeah.
You had the flexibility to take some time off to get things established and then to kind of manage
and
them
even,
as you went along.
And even in the years when I was working full time, I would come into the shop on Saturdays and I would do stuff in the evenings. So my background is, as you alluded to, is kind of a bit different because I started out college as a textiles major. I actually thought not so much that I would go into fashion, but I was very intrigued by that sort of general textile arena. And, one of the many varied things I've done in my life is I was a gospel singer for a couple of years and traveled with a couple of gospel groups when I was in my early 20s. And one of the groups I traveled with was before I went to college. The other group was actually I took some time off college. So I went to school. I went to Seattle Pacific, which is a small Christian college in Seattle. And after my sophomore year, one of the groups came around looking for people for their summer groups that they did. This was an organization that did both one full-time group and a summer group. And I actually auditioned for one of the summer groups. And then a couple months later, they called and said, well, actually, we'd like you to come travel with our full-time group.
Wow.
And I went, well, okay. And I was kind of at the point where I'm at the theme kind of towards the middle of my sophomore year, not really quite sure if I'm in the right place in terms of what I want to do with my major.
And you still had your eye on textiles at that time.
I still had my own textiles. I was still essentially a home economics major. And so I went off traveling for a year. When I came back, I took another 6 or 8 months, worked in a bank actually was managed by the aunt of a friend of mine. And when I came back to school, I came back in the middle of the calendar year. So I didn't come back in September. I came back in January. Needed to take a couple of extra courses in terms of load. I was working full time then. I was working for a bank. And there was a computer class in programming, and it sounded intriguing. And so I took it just because it sounded interesting and I needed the credits. And that changed my life. About halfway through the quarter, my professor came to me and said, I really think you should change your major. And I said, well, I kind of want to give it at least through the quarter before I make that decision. Before the quarter ended, a small company in Seattle that was an accounting firm, they bought a computer. They were building their own accounting software because that didn't exist in mm-hmm. the early 1980s. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed for them, got a job with them. So by the time I finished college, I was 25. I had worked full time as a programmer for a couple of years, and it just changed the course of my life. The shop is the marriage between the two halves of my life. It's the marriage between my technical geeky side and my creative, colorful, I love to make things side. This mm-hmm. really is the combination of both halves of my brain and both halves of my life.
So for you, unlike many shop owners, the internet and online sales were really something you could rapidly embrace then.
Oh, definitely. Because my day job when I started the shop was I was managing the internet engineering group at Sun Microsystems.
So
my day job was the internet.
You take me back because at about that time I was working at a trade magazine, Research and Development. And my
Which magazine were you working for?
Research and Development was what it was called, R&D magazine.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And my area of expertise was semiconductors and vacuum technology.
Okay.
So I was out in your area all the time. for trade shows and media, you know, Sun Microsystems. I mean, I remember that. That was the kingpin.
Sun built all its own hardware. So
right, yeah. Oh yeah. So I was either there or in Boston, one or the other, all the time.
And that was actually where I mostly traveled to, because I had staff in the Boston office as well. Uh-huh. So I traveled a lot to the Boston area. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that as I talk to people who have, many of my colleagues that have started shops in the last 20 years have been, as I call it, refugees from corporate America. A lot of other people have gone from being in another industry, more corporate kind of thing, to this kind of thing. My really good friend Janine, who owns Acorns and Threads now, she used to be a water quality engineer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she used to work for people like Intel and help them help build plants around the world, and dealt with the water side of the semiconductor production industry.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of us that came from other kinds of jobs that migrated into this as a sort of, in some cases, as a safety net from how stressful the day job was. And then you realized, you know, I could actually make a living doing this.
Yeah, well, the one that I know quite well is Kim Young of Sassy Jack. She's another one.
Yeah, and she's made a really successful business as well. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and I also think that coming from the corporate world, you get the whole business concept, even if you haven't necessarily done a small business before. All of the pieces that kind of go together to make it up are not so foreign, and it doesn't seem quite so overwhelming.
Oh, that's very much the truth. Yeah, because so many start, it's a hobby and it kind of grows into a business, but they're not business oriented people. And so they have to learn the hard way a lot of things. And the successful ones are the ones who dig in and get it. But, you know, there's just an awful lot of people whose businesses did not succeed for very long because they just didn't have the business side of their brain to work with. And then, yeah, people like you who have come from that corporate world, you have a different approach. You start out with a plan. You start out with all kinds of business-oriented things, and then bring in the hobby part. And it gives you. I think it gives you a leg up, is what I think it gives.
Well,
you.
In my minor, when I actually switched my degree to computer science, so I did end up graduating with a degree in computer science, but my minor's in business. And because I worked for an accounting company, and I built my original job writing software was writing accounts payable, writing payroll, writing all those things.
Perfect.
So and I was a bookkeeper at multiple points in my former life, and so I still do the books. You know, day to day, I know how much is in every account. I know how much we've spent on Soie d'Alger this year. I mean, I know all of those things because that's just what I do.
And that's also interesting when you say that people have used the shop and needlework as an escape, because Christine and I have talked about this many, many times. And we've talked with guests about the same thing, is that that release that you get from needlework, that escape, and exactly that in the business world is even, you know, to have a shop as an escape from your day job is same concept. Yeah.
Well, and the kind of stress that I have owning a shop is different than the stress that I had working for somebody else.
Yes.
Being on somebody else's, not so much their clock, but I, you know, at the time I started the shop, I was working probably close to 100 hours a week at my day job.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided if I was going to work that much time, I wanted to spend it doing something that was more fulfilling. And so even though I don't work 100 hours a week anymore, but I still probably work close to about 70 hours a week because I'm here even when the shop isn't open or I'm working on something at home. But I don't at the end of the day or at the end of the week feel like, oh, gee, I wonder why I spent 5 hours or 25 hours in meetings all week. I spent, you know, amount of time ordering stuff, helping customers, answering questions. A large part of my job is really answering questions. I am kind of, as opposed to a, you know, just come cut a bunch of fabric for a customer. Today, for example, I spent probably an hour on the phone with various people answering questions.
Mm-hmm.
Where do I get this? Why can't I find this? I'm looking for this color. Well, unfortunately, that company doesn't make that thread anymore. So here's what you're going to have to use instead. Or somebody calls and says, I'm looking for this. Oh, this is what it's really called. It's not really called that name. So part of the fun for me is that, you know, I'm a murder mystery fan in my personal life. And so I kind of like the detective part of things in a different way. Owning a needlework store in some cases is kind of like being a weird sort of detective sometimes.
I never thought of it that way, but yeah, exactly. Yeah. Solving, because you're solving problems, finding things for people. Sometimes obscure things. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And for some perverse reason, I have a brain that keeps track of a lot of that stuff. I don't really know why. Occasionally somebody will ask me, why do you know that? And the answer is, I don't honestly know. You know, I know something from 20 years ago because I met somebody who did some weird technique and I remember they used some weird thing and suddenly it pops into my head and I can't tell you why. It's just there.
Yep. Well, and at some point that's the computer programmer coming out in you too, is
very likely.
Yeah,
yes.
remembering all those little things that come together and make a whole. Yes. Yeah. So tell me about the gospel singing. How does that happen? You just sing and start in a church singing as a kid?
Yeah. I've sung pretty much most of my life. I don't really do any anymore because there's just not enough hours in the day. But I had sung in my church, in the various churches that I'd gone to over the years. And the first group I traveled with was the church I belonged to at the time was a Free Methodist church, which is actually based out of Indiana. And they had a full-time group that traveled, usually made up of people in their late teens, you know, out of high school, early college age. And there were 10 of us. We traveled only in the States. We didn't travel overseas. We just traveled in the U.S. And they came around and would occasionally do auditions for churches, or they would invite people to do audition tapes because, you know, that was in the cassette days long before CDs and DVDs. There was no video.
Back in time we go here.
And I sang a lot at not just my local church, but I sang at other churches in the area. And so I was invited to do an audition for them, and I did. And so the year after I was out of high school, I had not decided if I wanted to go to college yet. I was taking some courses at a community college, got mono, you know, how teenagers that happens.
Yep.
And so when I got well, this thing came up and I thought, you know what, I really want to do this. And it was a really great experience for a variety of reasons. One was just because I love singing, and so it was a lot of fun in that regard. Because there was a small group of 10 of us, we traveled around in a not really a van. It was kind of like an old, not really quite station wagon. I forget what the vehicle was called. I'd have to go look it up. And we had a caravan thing we toted with us that had all the equipment in it. And we sang to recorded soundtracks. So which were done for us, actually. It was music that was done for us. We recorded an album. The group was called Free Spirit. We recorded an album and we did it in the Bill Gaither studios that were not far away from where the church's headquarters in Indiana were. And so we had soundtracks that were recorded by professional orchestras that we actually sang to. And it was a really fabulous learning experience, particularly as a teenager, as a late teen, early 20s person, of how to get along with a group of people. It was like being married to 9 other people because you were around each other all the time. How to deal with conflicts when you couldn't really escape. You know, it's not like even in college where you can go to your room because you don't have a room to go to. How to be with people not just the people that you traveled with, but the people that you were staying with, whether they were hosts or whether it was the church group that you were singing to and ministering to. And we sang mostly in Free Methodist churches, but not exclusively. We did sing in churches and groups from other things. We were actually on the 700 Club show once. Mm. So it kind of ran the gamut for the kinds of things we did. And when the opportunity came up to do it a few years later, a couple, 3 years later, for a different organization in a different group that had a different, we did. So the second group I traveled with was called Jeremiah People. And we didn't just sing, we did acting as well. So we did sketches, we did some comedy, we did some drama, and we did a lot of singing as well. And I think all of those things just prepared me for other things that would, you know, happen later in my life, and for interacting with people, being how to know when to be on and when not to be on, because that sometimes happens even in my job here as a shop owner. This is something that customers of any needlework store, any retail store, need to know. It's hard to always be on.
Yes.
It's hard to always be at your personal best. And there are days when we have, as I would call them, bad hair days. There are days when, you know, either we woke up and have, you know, a bad headache, have a migraine, but you still have to go to work. And when you're in a day job that you can hide behind a telephone, that's a lot easier to handle.
Yep.
It's really hard to handle when you're in a day job like this, where you're in the forefront. And that being doing those two things helped me, but it certainly, even at this age, I still have days where I sometimes kind of want to just crawl under the desk because I'm tired or my head hurts or whatever, and I can't really do it. And, but those kind of experiences just really helped me a lot in later in life with so many other things. But most of all, I just remember them as being great fun. It was a lovely group of people in both cases that I traveled with. We kept in touch for a few years after both of those organizations. I've lost touch with most of them over the last probably 20 years, because that was more than 40 years ago. And, you know, nowadays I could probably find most of them in some capacity on, you know, Facebook or some other thing. But it's, those are definitely things I would not have traded. Had I gone to college right out of high school, whether I would have ended up with a degree in something like textiles or something, I don't know. I probably would have taken a different path, but it all led to, you know, the path of where I ended up. I think all experiences can be interesting and learning, and those were years that I really, living out of a suitcase wasn't always the most fun.
Right.
But I think even I think if somebody asked me today to go do it for a month, I would do it. Mm-hmm. Ask me to do it for a year. I don't know, at 63, I would do it, but I would definitely do it for a month, because I just have such great feelings about what had happened those years that I did that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that whole thing, knowing when to be on, you know, I'm a former science teacher, and I've often thought that that's probably the most draining part of teaching, is that there's a significant element of entertainment in teaching, in that you have to be energetic and enthusiastic and on, you know, in every class. And, you know, there are just some days where you just don't have it. And when you go to the corporate world.
Yeah.
And,
I think teachers in particular have that probably in spades, more so than most other professions.
Because
even if you're in a profession like, you know, acting, or say you're, you know, a broadcast person, whether you're, you know, a football announcer or you're an anchor for a newscast, you can step away from the camera.
Right.
That's a lot harder to do in a teaching position, or sometimes even in somebody in a medical profession. But I think people don't necessarily think about it in relation to retail stores, because they just kind of assume, well, you know, you've got a lunchroom to go to. Well, okay, that might be true. You work for a Target. But if you go to 99% of most needlework stores, most of us don't have a big enough space to have a dedicated space that people can get away from. I do occasionally tell my staff, it's like, if you're having a day where you need to take 5 minutes or 10 minutes and go walk around the building, go do that. Because sometimes you just need to be able to step away from whatever it is you're doing, whether it's I've cut fabric and I've now cut it wrong, because trust me, that happens. And you get frustrated at yourself, and sometimes you just kind of need to step away. And it's a little harder to do in a retail environment, but, you know, sometimes you just kind of have to do that.
Yeah. Oh, and that's so true. And my wife Margaret and I, we work at home. We're magazine editors. And that's one of the many pluses to working at home. but one of them is exactly that. And every now and then it's like, all right, I'm out. I'm going to go walk around the block and I'll be back when I cool off and get a perspective, I'll be back. And, you sometimes just need that. And So, all right. You said start a shop that you wanted to shop in. What is that shop?
Well, because I was traveling and seeing shops all around the country, and I have a fairly eclectic interest in terms of the things I do. I learned how to do embroidery from my grandmother. I taught myself how to do needlepoint when I traveled with the First Gospel Group. I learned how to cross stitch in the, mid to late 70s. And I was living in Seattle still at that time. And went to
not hard to find cross stitch at that time.
It was about the time that it really took off, and you could find, granted you didn't have really big shops in lots of places, but there were lots of small shops, and we had a really great little small shop in the part of Seattle that I lived in. And so by the time I was working in high tech and traveling a lot more, and had moved back to California. So I lived in Seattle until 84. I moved back at the beginning of 84. My father had gotten really ill, and it was time to come home and be around him, because it looked like that might not last for more than a few more years, which turned out to be the case. And so I would go to places and I'd find silks, or I'd find silk gauze. I'd shop at Needlewoman East out on the East Coast. I'd shop at places where I could find more sort of esoteric high-end things, but it was hard to find everything I wanted in one place. I couldn't find some place that had, silk ribbon for silk ribbon embroidery, that had high-end linens, that had heirloom quality stuff, that had, more than one kind of silk, or that had more than, say, 10 kinds of threads. And so I thought, you know what? I want to build a shop that has those things. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, we've got more threads now than what we started with. But when I started the shop 20 years ago, I think I started with like 40 different kinds of threads.
Oh, and my, you dove into the deep end.
And when I would bring a thread in, I wouldn't just bring in a few colors. I would bring in an entire line. So when I purchased needlepoint ink silks, which was one of the first ones I brought in, I didn't buy like, I'll pick like 20 colors and kind of grow from there. It was like, I bought all of them. I bought every single color. I did the same thing with Soie d'Alger. I actually originally carried Soie d'Alger from Krynek, because Krynek was distributing for Avera Soie at that point. I didn't meet Lamora at Access probably until I'd been in business for maybe a year or so. And I started buying from her as well. And then eventually I switched over to just buying all my Soie d'Alger from all of my Avera Soie threads from her. In fact, these days, Access Commodities is the only company I order from every week. Everybody else I might order from every couple of weeks. I order every Saturday from Access because people eat Soie d'Alger.
We'd be hard pressed to have a hobby without Access Commodities, wouldn't we?
Definitely the hobby that I do. Yes. Yeah. So I really just wanted to find, so the tagline for the shop is Needle in a Haystack, Purveyor of Fine Needlework Supplies. And I picked that for a reason, because I wanted it to be about not so much expensive, but quality that I was looking for. You weren't going to find, really craft quality stuff in my store, and that didn't denigrate the craft quality stuff. It's just that wasn't the target market I was after. I was after the people who wanted to be able to buy quality hand-dyed linens, be able to buy quality silks, and ultimately a lot of, say, hand-dyed stuff, because that was at the transition point where there were starting to be more companies doing hand-dyed. Lakeside Linens is the same age as we are. There are a number of other companies that kind of all came into being around that sort of, mid to late 80s timeframe, where at the time I started, Gloriana didn't exist then. We'll talk about that in a minute. But Karen Collection was still primarily the main hand-dyed company. Others were starting to come about. So Gentle Arts for sampler threads, there were other companies starting to come about that at that point. And I was intrigued by all of those. I thought, oh, this is kind of fun. I like this. And so I would just go to shows and look for things that appealed to me. It's like, if I want to use this, I think I can convince other people to do that as well.
Did you have,
and that's kind of where it came from.
Yeah, you're building, you know, that's a rather unique niche. Did you have a client base in the area that allowed you to build that, or did you have to reach out beyond your local area to really get enough customers?
Well, fortunately, because I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, that reach actually is a pretty large swath of people. You know, it's mm-hmm. like within a 100-mile radius, there's like, I don't know, I think 5 or 6 million people. This is a big area. I might not have built the same kind of store if I'd lived in an area where the population was 100,000. I mean, my town that I live in, the population's about 75. I would never have been a local store for just Alameda. It had to reach beyond that. And I knew that there was an audience there because I used to go to the Spirit of Cross Stitch festivals. Mm. So the year that I opened the store was right after the last Spirit of Cross Stitch festival in Sacramento. And I knew that audience was there. And in fact, the last year they did it, I put flyers out at the festival, which was actually how I found Ada, my shop manager. I put flyers out at the festival, and they allowed me to do that, that the shop was going to be opening, you know, the following year. And so I knew the audience was there because I had talked to so many other stitchers going to that event that I knew I wasn't just, you know, screaming into the wind, so to speak.
Right.
That if I built it, that audience was there. And it was kind of like in California, we used to have a department store called Mervyn's. And they used to do an ad where for like their Christmas sale, there would be the shoppers at the window with their hands on the door, sort of almost like they were squeezing the window, trying to squeeze the window. And the person would say, open, open, open. I had people actually do that.
Oh my.
While we were getting stuff set up, they would come by and they'd stand at the window and they'd look in and they'd kind of mouth off to me, open, open, open kind of thing. So, you know, I knew the audience was there and that I wasn't taking a huge risk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. Cause, you know, without the internet, you had to go with something like a trade show to be able to determine that you had an audience. Cause yeah, otherwise tough to find.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, because Spirit of Cross Stitch, it had reached sort of the end of its life by that point, but it had shown that there was clearly an audience for really quality stuff. One of the people I used to buy from regularly was a vendor that came to that show, and that was where I got introduced to Soie d'Alger. And there were people doing small businesses in other parts of the country, not in the Bay Area, that had sort of components of what I wanted to do. And they were actually very helpful. So even though I started this shop from scratch, I didn't buy it from anybody else. I didn't buy any part of it from anybody else. I had lots of people who helped me along the way, who I would go to and I would ask questions of, and I would say, so where do I source this? And they were all very supportive. I never met anyone in those years of starting that wouldn't answer my questions, that they recognized that, you know, there's a fine line between competition and cooperative competition. For some people, competition is all about shutting out the other businesses because you think if you're the last person standing, you're going to win. You don't see that very frequently in our world. You see that more often, I think, in other industries. In our world, you see more the cooperative kind of business where people answer questions. I had a shopover friend of mine today call me and ask me a question. She said, I always call you because I know either you'll know the answer or you'll have some creative way of solving it.
Uh-huh.
And that's true for a lot of people is that, you know, I have my shop owner buddies that I talk to regularly, but I also have a lot of vendors that I talk to when I'm contemplating bringing in something new. I might, you know, call and have a conversation about, so, you know, how is it sold for you as a wholesaler? What kind of audience you know, what kind of shop is your, has been the audience for this product. Mm-hmm. And I think if you can go into it, knowing that you have to do a bunch of research, that's kind of where the R&D comes in. You know, you're a different kind of R&D than what you were covering, but it's the same sort of thing.
Right. Well, we talk about that from time to time in the magazine business because, you know, name a topic and there are two or three trade magazines for it. And we've had many conversations over the years where, I'd like to put that magazine out of business and that one out of business. And we always, the end of that conversation is always, be careful what you do, because if you eliminate all of them, then the question that comes up is, do you have a market? There's no yeah. competition. So is there even a market? And then what have you done to yourself? And
the last man or the last shop or the last magazine or whatever, the last thing left standing doesn't inherit everything. That's of what I think people forget is at some point, if needlework, whether it's cross stitch, whether it's knitting, whether it's needlepoint, embroidery, silk ribbon, whatever, if it's too hard for people to find things, then they stop doing it.
Right.
It's not that they will suddenly seek out the only one left in the country or in the area that does it. They will just stop trying to find it because it's too hard for them.
Yeah. No, that's exactly it. Yep. And then it's gone.
Yep. Yes.
It's simply
yes.
gone. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm doing one of the magazines I edit is for manufacturing people. And lately I've been doing, actually I'm doing a podcast this week with a managing partner from a company in Germany, talking about company culture and how the right culture builds your business. And you speak very highly of your staff. You have a staff and it sounds like a culture that is a big part of the success of your business.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I think that most successful shops, that's the case. I mean, it's not to say that you can't have a successful shop and be a sole owner and you're the only one who does it. But if you grow beyond that being manageable, then you have to find good staff people. I've had a number of staff over the years. My longest existing staff person is Debbie, who has been with me for 15, actually probably close to 18 years now. She had been working full-time for a long time. She lives about 30 miles away. She actually works for the Container Store these days, but still works one day a week for me. she loves being able to come in and do that because it feeds a part of her life, you know, kind of what we were talking about before. And it's a different sort of retail than what she does in her job. As an alpha person in particular at the Container Store. Jennifer is my next longest one. Jennifer's been here for, I think, 10 years now, pretty close to that. My two newest people, Marissa has been working for me for about a year and a half, and Karen just started about 2 months ago. Simone, who'd been working for me for a couple of years, she's gone off to grad school. She's studying forensics. And so she needed to spend more time studying. And so she got a TA position, which was great for her. But, you know, part of what I've always looked for in people is I can teach you about how to do needlework. That's actually not the hard part. The hardest part is actually color.
Mm-hmm.
So you might think, oh, yeah, well, you need to find experienced stitchers. It's like, no, you need to find people who, A, know it's a job as opposed to just fun, because you need it to be a job that's fun as opposed to fun that's a job. And you need people who can see color. And that's not a skill set that's easy to teach. You can, if people have a general feeling for it, you can teach them nuances. But if they can't tell when they look at something that there are five shades of red there, then you're going to have a really hard time, particularly with the amount of thread we carry. It makes it a lot harder.
Yeah.
So I've always gravitated towards people who feel like they can, that's something they can tackle. But I've also been very clear with people. It's like, you know, the job is to help customers. The job is to not necessarily tell a customer what to do, but to help them figure out what they want to do. And that's sometimes a little different. Some of the shops I used to shop in when I was traveling, particularly because in the 70s and early 80s, a lot of the shop owners, particularly needlepoint stores, you would go in, you'd get a canvas, and they would have picked all the threads for you. You didn't really have any say in it. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the kind of shop I wanted to have. One of my longtime customers, the first year she started shopping with us, she would always want me to pick her colors. And I would tell her, I'm not going to do it. I said, I will help you pick selections. I'll tell you things I think you might want to try, but in the end, you're going to have to figure this out. And it took me an entire year to get her to the point where she would go and pick everything on her own. She would still bring it back and ask one of us to help her with, do you think these go together? But I wanted her to get to the point of being able to feel comfortable because she was the one who needed to stitch it, not me.
Right, right.
So I've always tried to find staff who understand that you need to encourage people, but you don't need to make the decision for them. And sometimes that changes the kind of people that you hire, because you need to hire people who feel comfortable saying to a customer, you know, I wouldn't stitch with that because that's not my favorite color, but is it your favorite color? Mm-hmm. And the person might go, well, it is. Then go for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that, yeah, that color is so critical because, I mean, that's an area I struggle with. Christine and I were just talking about this past Wednesday, is I bought Trish Burr's book because I'm going to force myself to learn how colors go together, because I'm just not very good at it. I know what I like, but if I have to select colors to change the colors of a chart, I have to have somebody like you have in your store to help me, because I can't pull it off. I can say, all right, I want this to be blues and whites, but boy, I need somebody who can really see color to make it work. And
well, the other thing though that you can do in that regard though is, because I've taught classes to people over the years on at some of the guilds for like how we go about doing it, and it's not because we have an in-depth knowledge of color theory, it's because we've learned a method that works. So what I usually tell people is, if you're fortunate enough to have access to whatever the original color was, then pull those colors and start from there, because you want the same value. You might want the same hue. I don't want it to be purple. I want it to be blue, but I know that it's going to need to be kind of in the relationship between those colors needs to be similar. It doesn't need to be identical, but it needs to be similar. So it's a lot harder, and I have a hard time doing it just completely from scratch. If somebody told me, oh, you know, create a design and do it with this, I'm a lot harder pressed to do that. If you tell me to take a design and change the colors to a completely different palette, I can do that because I know how those things relate to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I think doing something like Trish's stuff is really great because it does teach you to think about color in a different way than I think most of us think about it in terms of, you know, even say clothing.
Yeah.
You know, you go, well, yeah, I know those two colors work together, but they might work together in clothing, but they might not work together in stitching because the proximity is too close. Or, yeah, that lime green might be a really great color, but you might want to use it as a really sort of sparing accent color, because otherwise it's going to scream at you and overwhelm the piece.
Yeah. So true. Yeah.
And sometimes you want your needlework to scream. Halloween is a good time, but maybe not in an Easter project or maybe a wedding pillow. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. No, that's that's one of my new missions, is to just get better adept. I mean, I'm never going to get good at it, but to get better adept at it. And, you know, and one of the things that I struggle with is I have standard male red-green color blindness. It's not real.
Oh, that's a real challenge then. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not really severe in that I can't tell. But when you get into some of the shades, like when you said five shades of red, yeah, I just check out. I just mentally check out. I can't do that. So for me, it's like I can tell a red from a, you know, a brown or whatever. I mean, I certainly can do that. But you get into those subtle things, and I really struggle with it, which is probably why my favorite color is blue, because I don't have the problem there.
Yeah, so for you end up being able to compensate for that by sticking with colors that you can see the value differences between those. Yeah.
But still, even blues and those kinds of things, I just really feel like I need to spend some time just understanding how those colors go together and how they don't. And so that's my
mission. It is a learned skill, because even though I hire people who I think can manage dealing with color, they don't come into this being experts at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I would say any of us are experts at it. I mean, I know people who take a lot of classes in color theory and they're really fabulous at it. We're good at what we need to do for what we're doing for customers, for being able to help people either choose colors for a canvas or change colors in a project. But it's a little different than, you know, if you're doing, say, you know, you're a fashion designer and you're picking colors for some particular line of fashion. That's kind of a whole other gamut of color theory stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a couple of conversations with people who predict the color, you know, what are the colors going to be in 2 years and 5 years?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there's an amazing group of people, and how they derive those, they're not really predictions. I mean, they know exactly what's going to happen based on what people are doing today. And, there's a group of people that have an understanding of color in very, very great depth. And to be able to predict that, you know, in 5 years, purples are going to be hot. And so start planning on it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. That's a world. That's
well,
a world. Well,
and color doesn't change as much in our industry as it does in others. So if you take the quilting industry, for example, I go to the quilt market once every 3 years when it's in Portland, because I can go stay with my friend Janine, who owns Acorns and Threads. It's really interesting to see in other markets and other hobby craft related industries how much color changes. So in ours, it doesn't change that much that frequently. It will change, but the timeline might be on the scale of 2 to 5 years, whereas in the quilting industry, it might be as little as 3 months, because they're doing a line of the companies are doing lines of fabrics, either mm-hmm. for a season or for a particular, that they're also driven more by sort of following what's interesting in fashion.
Right. I was going to say, yeah, they're very closely tied to fashion because it's fabric. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. In that fashion world.
It mutates very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at fabric colors for, let's say, you know, Zweigart and Witchold, who are the two that have been around the longest for doing needlework fabric, there are colors they're still making today that they were making 40 years ago. Now there are colors they make today that they've only been making for 2 years, but there's a core in there that kind of stays consistent. And it's not just the white and the antique white and the natural. I mean, there's some other colors in there. Now you might, you know, lime, we got in one not too long ago that's light lime. So it's kind of a lighter version of a lime color. Well, you know, they did a mill run of it. So mill run's usually around 400 meters. That might be the only mill run they do, because it's not going to be a color that's probably likely to sell. You know, most shops aren't going to buy 100 yards in a year.
Yeah.
So it might be something they did because they thought, oh, you know, there's something in fashion maybe that might have spurred them on to do that. And it will come and it will go, but there are other colors that will stay consistently throughout the times.
Yeah.
So there are some things where you can find colors the same as what they were 20 years ago when a chart called for it. And then there's a whole other level of mutation that happens, particularly in the hand-dyed world.
Mm-hmm.
And plus companies tend to come and go too, which is the other thing.
Yeah, that changes the game. Yes. Yeah.
Yes, that changes the game substantially.
I've ordered from you twice, maybe three times. I forget.
Yeah, I think three.
But, you know, and
I remember three.
Okay. All right. But I just ordered a piece of Alba Maxima linen. And when I was ordering it from you, a question, and this was even before we were going to talk, it popped into my head. Is it getting these days harder to source good linens for embroidery, or good linens in general, or is it still fairly readily available?
Kind of depends on the specifics of the question. What's happened over the last 20 years is that the number of mills, particularly in Europe, which is where most of the really good stuff used to come from, and most of it still does, a lot of those went away. So either the companies closed, they sold the mills to companies not doing needlework related stuff. And so the ability to source from, say, 20 different mills has maybe gone down to a smaller number, a much smaller number. At one point, Zweigart, up until I think maybe 6 or 7 years ago, Zweigart used to have a mill in, I think, Switzerland, and the other one is in Germany. They only have the mill in Germany now. And that's true for a lot of other companies, where some of the reasons we can't get fabrics of a particular type anymore might be because the mill that was manufacturing it is no longer either in business, or they're just not making that particular kind of fabric anymore. So, yeah, the options have become more limited, which means that it's harder to find the really good stuff. Lamora at Access Commodities has become a good friend of mine, and we talk about fabric probably every week, if not sometimes every couple of days. And she spends a lot of her time trying to source really great quality stuff. The most recent stuff she's brought in is from Sodoma, which is a company in Italy. I'd heard of them, but I'd never seen their linen. Somebody had asked me about them, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, and there wasn't anybody importing them into the U.S. And she got contacted by them, and they sent her swatch books, and she sent some of the swatch books to me. And I think we spent one day on the phone for 2 hours going through swatch books. Well, what about this one? Oh, I like the color of that one. Ooh, I like the feel of that one. And I'm actually just doing some sample stitching on the 37 count that she brought in. The hand on this fabric, which to me means how it drapes and how it feels when you're stitching. It's very smooth. It's not scratchy. It is an even weave. It is 37 both directions. It's just a really fabulous linen, and it comes in a bunch of different colors. She brought in, I think, 4 out of the 10 or 12 that it comes in. So, you know, if you've got a vendor like Lamora who spends her time sourcing the really good stuff, then as a shop owner, it's not so hard. If you don't have a relationship with a company like that, so sometimes shops and designers don't necessarily know who to go to. If they've primarily been buying from a distributor other than Axis, so if they primarily just been buying, say, Zweigart fabric, they might not necessarily know that there are other companies that bring in high-end linens, both for counted and for embroidery. But certainly at the embroidery end of the scale, it's harder to find them just because there are fewer mills manufacturing them these days. A lot of the mills moved overseas, moved out of Europe, and moved to Southeast Asia. Oh. And they're not doing the quality control that they were doing when the mills were in Europe, or they just don't think that the market's there for that. Even Zweigart's fabric has changed over the last 20 years. Actually, it's changed substantially in the last 10. And I don't know if it's my assumption. I've never actually talked to the people at Zweigart about this, but my assumption is that they've tried to manage the balance between costs rising and not being able to and not pricing the fabric out of the market.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at a piece of, say, Belfast linen from 20 years ago. So I've been stitching for, as I said, most of my life. I have pieces of fabric I've owned for 40 years. I have some silk gauze I bought like 35 years ago that's not the same quality as what you can get today. And I have some Zweigart fabrics that I bought probably 35 years ago. The quality of that fabric is different than the quality today. Mm-hmm. It's the base threads are thinner. They're not as consistent in diameter. I mean, they're still an even weave in the true sense of the word. They are, the warp and weft count the same, but in terms of the diameter of the threads, there's a lot more variation in the thick and thin than there used to be. And it's still a good quality linen, but it's not the quality that it was 20 years ago. But yet I'm also not paying 5 times as much.
Yeah.
So it's a trade-off. I had this conversation with a customer not too long ago who asked about something in particular. And I said, well, you know, they could probably make it the same way. But if they did, instead of you paying $80 a yard for that fabric at the retail level, you might be paying $300 a yard. So do you really want to pay that? And they kind of went, no. It's like, so that's the trade-off. And I think that's the challenge for the manufacturers, particularly in niche markets like ours, because we are a very niche market. people like to say, like to think, I think, oh, well, needlework, you know, there's a lot of people doing stitching. When you look at it from the fabric and the thread into the scale, we are a niche market in a niche market. I mean, we're definitely, you know, there's a reason why there are a lot of hand dyed companies and a lot of small manufacturers, and most of our vendors are one in two people companies, because the number of companies that are doing it at the large scale are few and far between.
We within the hobby get kind of a warped perspective, because when you're running a big mill and you fire up something, you got to be able to run a lot of cloth, and if you're not going to move it, you know, it's not going to ever get made.
You know, 15 years ago, Swigart was manufacturing, probably at one point they had 4 or 5 shades of yellow in linen. They don't even have one now. Now, and some of that is partly just that colors change over time as to what's popular. As designers change the style, you go back and you look at, so I have a filing cabinet that's in the closet in one of my, the spare bedroom that we actually use as a library. We have built-in bookcases because my husband and I are both book people. I have charts that I bought in the 1970s, and I go back and I look at some of those and I go, oh my God, how the styles have changed. you know, it's not just the Dale Burdett cute little teddy bears, which I still keep those charts because I still like those little teddy bears. But it's very different today for the kinds of things that are popular. And as that mutates over time, that also drives what's available and what manufacturers want to make. So if the market has moved more towards funky contemporary stuff, they're more likely to do, for example, a light lime. And if it's really kind of sticking more towards, you know, the 18th century, 17th, 16th century samplers, maybe they're not going to venture into that. And they're going to think that those colors aren't really popular. So I don't know how much the companies like the company. So Witchell doesn't manufacture their own linens and their Joblin fabric. They have mills in Europe that do that for them. Perman makes their linen. And I don't know how much those companies go out and talk to other people to figure out like where the trends are, and not just the trends in fashion, home deck, those kind of industries, but where are the trends in needlework? I don't actually know how much attention they pay to that, or if they just think, okay, well, we think this color could be popular, so let's just do it. My guess is that it's more the latter than the former. Yeah. That it's more they kind of think, well, let's try a color and see if that's popular. You know, we have some spare time in the mill runs or something. And they've cut back, in Swigart's case, they've cut back so many colors in the last 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. It's a fraction of what they used to do that I think they're kind of slowly introducing some fun things. I think in part because maybe they just think they need to add some fun to the mill. I'm sure as a mill person, it's way more fun to watch the mill run a 400 yards of light lime than it is to watch the 400 yards of antique white.
Yeah, you can count on that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It. All right. 20 years. Do you think that needlework is on an upswing these days?
Yes. It's like all things in the craft world, there are cyclical things. You're going to find times where particular components of needlework are more popular than others. You know, 10 years ago, knitting was the craze, and really needlepoint and cross stitch had kind of taken a back seat to that. So, you know, a great example is Portland. You know, at the height of the knitting thing, I think Portland had 15 knitting shops. I think there are 2 or 3 left now. Mm. In the Bay Area, there are 9 of us left. At one point, there were 14. And some of that is that people age out. They retire. They don't want to do it anymore. Buying a needlework shop is a hard thing to do. That's a whole other discussion. And so for a lot of people, when it's time to retire, they're just done. They don't want to have to deal with trying to sell it, or they can't find a buyer for it because it's too expensive. So it took a significant downturn after 2008. And that wasn't because people were less interested in stitching. It was because it affected so many people's pocketbooks. Yeah. So our sales dived. I don't know a single shop owner that 2009 and 10 weren't not, were pretty bad years. And it took a long time for it to come back as people felt comfortable spending more than just their current project. So most of us didn't completely go out of business because it wasn't that people stopped stitching. It was that they stopped accumulating at the same level. So, you know, there was a time when for a number of the really popular designers, we had customers who would buy everything that designer put out. The designer released five new charts. That person, those set of people, they would buy all five charts. They had no intention of stitching them right away, but they bought them because they were fans. After 2008, that pretty much dropped almost instantaneously. Mm-hmm. People were much more critical about what they spent their money on. They wanted value for their dollar. And the value wasn't necessarily in terms of physical value. It was more an intrinsic value to them. I really still like that designer, but I'm only going to buy that one because that's the one I really love. So instead of coming in and buying 40 charts, they might come in and only buy two. Mm-hmm. No, they were still buying. They just weren't buying as much. And the other shift for us happened, particularly because in the Bay Area, you know, housing is expensive, traffic is horrible, is that what we saw after that time frame was the shift. That was the real beginning of the serious shift to online sales for us. Well, online and mail order in some capacity, whether it's somebody sending us an email or somebody picking up the phone and calling us. And that a lot of it changed even within the Bay Area. So the bridge toll to get across, the bridge between us and San Francisco, even if you have a fast pass, is like $5. Well, if you're buying 40 skeins of Soie d'Alger, I can ship it to you less expensively than you can come and get them.
Right, right, exactly.
So that was the other thing that happened in that same time frame, was that because people were thinking more seriously about, do I spend money on this or do I spend it on that? In some cases, it was they said, if I don't come into the shop physically, I am less likely to spend money I shouldn't. So I'm only going to order the things I need. Mm-hmm. So for us, the bad news was they weren't coming into the shop anymore.
Right.
Because it meant that the opportunity sales that every retail business, it doesn't matter whether you're a needlework store or Starbucks, that we depend on. But it meant that they were still spending money. They were just doing it at a lower level and in a different way. So if we couldn't adapt to that, then that was really what was going to kill us in the end. And I think that's what happened to most shops, was that we had to adapt to people not wanting to spend the level that they had been at, and that they were going to buy in a slightly different way. You know, go forward from 2008 to 2018, it's very different now. It's still not the way it was in 2007. People still don't buy in that same way. But they are spending more freely. They are kitting up more projects. But I think a lot more people are doing it with a project in mind and not so much just pure stash enhancement, at least within my customer base. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people will ask me, are you a cross-stitch shop or a needlepoint store? And my answer is, I'm a thread store. That's really what I started out to be, and that's what we still are. We carry at this point 130 different kinds. Actually, it might be more than that because I would have to actually go count them. And we sell several hundred yards of both regular and hand-dyed fabrics, and those things support whatever project somebody wants to do. Mm-hmm. So whether you're a canvas person, whether you're a hand-painted needlepoint person, we do carry charts. We do carry hand-painted needlepoint, but that's a smaller part of my business than the threads and the fabrics. And because of that, people might come back and they go, oh, well, you know, I bought this chart 15 years ago, but I want to kit it now. Now, in some cases, that can be a challenge because some of what they're after, the companies are gone. Yeah. Fortunately, I have a pretty extensive knowledge of most of those, so I can usually give somebody suggestions for what to change. Yeah, Needle Necessities is gone, but the person who owns Threadworks used to die for Needle Necessities. When they started the company, they redid most of the same similar things. They're not identical, but they're in the ballpark. Or, you know, you can't find, DMC doesn't make Medici anymore. They haven't made Medici for probably close to 12 years, actually, maybe longer ago than that. It's probably closer to 15 now. But, you know, there are other threads on the market like Fleur de Paris, Bella Lusso, that are in the ballpark of sort of weight. So some of what changed is that I think after the recession, people got very worried about where the money was going. And so they spent less on their needlework. They were still spending, but they spent less. As time went by, economy improved, people's incomes in terms of what they could spend on discretionary money, because this is discretionary money. I think that they felt more comfortable spending on either more projects or on a more pricey project. So maybe they wouldn't have bought a sampler that's done with 40 colors of Soie d'Alger and a half a yard of fabric 10 years ago, but they feel comfortable doing that now because maybe that's the one project that they're going to do for the next 6 months.
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely come back, and it's come back also in a younger audience as well, but in a different way. So we're not seeing as many people. We are seeing people in the under 30 crowd, but we're not seeing as many of them. Where they tend to go is mostly online. So they may be buying from us because Mary Corbett, they're an embroidery person. They've read Mary's blog. Mary talks about particular kinds of threads or fabrics. They don't have a local store, so they come and get stuff from us. But there are a lot of new designers who are cropping up on not only their own sites, but are doing stuff through Etsy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole other level of generational stitchers that they didn't have a mom or a grandmother or an uncle or a brother. They didn't have anybody directly who stitched, and so they didn't learn that way. They've learned from YouTube videos, and quite frankly, that's where the growth is going to come from. It's going to come from YouTube.
Yeah.
It's going to come from the audience of people, whether they're 65, whether they're 25, or whether they're 45, who maybe don't have a local store. They figure that they kind of want to learn how to do something. You know, if you go and look at what was on YouTube 3 years ago, there was a really small smattering of needlework related stuff as people started tagging their videos for floss tube so that people would know there's kind of a needlework contingent out there. It's reached the threshold where if you want to know how to do pretty much any kind of needlework stitch, you can just Google YouTube floss tube, you know, what the stitch is. And trust me, somebody has shown you how to do it.
Yeah.
Or they might have reviewed some particular topic or a particular product. So that has, I think, brought a lot of some new people into it and has brought some people back. In my age group and yours of my age group, for a lot of people, they're coming back to it because maybe they were off in a career where it didn't give them a whole lot of time to stitch, and now they've got time. And so they're coming back to finding that not only has the landscape completely changed, that the threads or the fabrics that they knew 20 years ago or 30 years ago are not just gone, but now instead of, oh, I remember when I could only buy Pattern Ann and, you know, DMC floss. It's like,
yes.
Oh, honey, that time has marched on. You're in a whole different world now. So it's definitely growing. It's not, I don't know that it's ever going to be quite what it was, you know, 10, 12 years ago, in terms of the way people purchase, but I'm okay with that because I think people pay more attention to what they buy now. It's less about stash accumulation. That's not to say it doesn't happen and it's not fun, but I think it's more about stash accumulation with a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more, oh, I'm going to buy that because I really do want to stitch that versus I'm just going to buy it because I happen to follow that particular designer.
Yeah. Kathy, I've enjoyed it. We got to stop.
Oh, no problem. Maybe we'll do another one in the future.
Yeah, because there's a whole lot more on the list that we didn't get to. So, yeah, that's going to happen.
Well, you know, we'll plan another one at some point down the road.
Yep, we will. You're on the short list. We'll come back.
Excellent.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
And thanks for doing this, because I think that you're actually talking to a lot of different people gives stitchers out there a whole, and even shop owners who, like me, who listen to various things, a different perspective that maybe they don't get otherwise. So you're doing a great service.
Well, thank you for that. We sure enjoy doing it. It's a lot of fun. So, all right. Thank you, Kathy. Thanks to everybody for listening. And Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.